Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report Business Roundtable. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. Another big week on Wall Street. More bad news for Boeing as it faces a U.S. criminal investigation over the door plug that blew off an Alaska Airlines 737 MAX jet, and the giant faces more ridicule in the wake of its quality lapses. United Airlines has had its turn in the barrel with four emergency landings this month, prompting some to question the safety of one of the world's leading airlines. Palantir beats legacy primes to win the U.S. Army's future targeting system. Russia intercepts a conversation among German generals and targets the Ukrainian and Greek prime minister. Joining us today to discuss all this and more are Dr. Rocket Ron Epstein of Bank of America Securities, Sash Tusa of the independent equity research firm Agency Partners, and Richard Abalafi of the Aerodynamic Advisory Consultancy. And I thank two of our number in particular, Ron and Richard, who are on the road and joining us as we have leapt ahead in the United States and reduced the gap to Sash to 4 hours. Everybody, thanks so very much for joining me as always today. Ron, start us off. Another big week on the market. How did the group perform against that? And what are some broader sentiments?
Yeah, I think the real driver in the market was Secretary Powell's commentary around interest rates and where they could go. I'll do things a little bit out of order. The 10-year yield, you know, came down this week. We're just a little bit over four. So we're seeing it start to trend down. The S&P itself was essentially flat. It was down, 26 basis points. So not very much. When you look across the group, I mean, the names that really outperformed had, you know, some very company specific stuff going on. Palantir, as you mentioned, won the Titan program. And they were up almost 5% on the week. General Electric, GE Aviation specifically, had an investor day, and the GE shares were up almost 6% on that. The performance this week in the market, and the real driver was Secretary Powell's commentary around interest rates. Probably the most important thing, I think, to talk about is the 10-year yield. It's trending down. It's just a smidge above 4%. And we're seeing that as a trend. So the market really is, I think, starting to discount in the Fed cutting rates. And that's had an impact on names that are more sensitive to that. I'd say more broadly on A&D, performance this week was largely company specific around company specific events. The best performer in aerospace and defense land was GE. Specifically, GE Aviation had an investor meeting this week, and the shares ended up almost 6% on their commentary. Palantir was up almost 5%, and that was based on winning the Titan program as a prime, leading the team. They beat a Raytheon-led team on that. L3Harris was up 2%. Textron was up almost 4%. But broadly, when you look at the market itself, the market was essentially flat. Boeing was down 1%, not surprising given all the news. And in particular on Boeing, it closed below 200, which is sort of this mental support level that people have been talking about. Right. And it's the first time it's closed before that in a really long time. Lockheed was up 1.5%. Northrop was up 1%. Raytheon, or RTX, excuse me, was up 1%. So I'd say broadly, defense outperformed commercial, but there was a lot of company-specific stuff going on. And then finally, the VIX index, which is a measure of kind of the fear and loathing in the market, has been trending up, and that might be we hear from investors. It'd be interesting to hear Sasha's take on this. Concern about valuations in the market, that the market's done quite well, but valuations are richer than they were at the start of the year, and that always brings a little bit of consternation with it. And then finally, the most boring thing has been oil. WTI crude closed the week at 78 and Brent crude at 82. And they've been in that range now for months and months and months.
And basically, even though the new jobs rate was not as strong as in the past, right? That's one of the things that was, it's fascinating to watch the market, right? Like the jobs numbers are very good. The market rises, even though concerns are that the Fed's not going to cut rates now because the economy is still hot. So that diminution, sort of folks were taking it in stride that this actually helps, combined with the chairman's comments that there could be rate cuts in the future effectively, right, is another way of looking at it, that the economy is slowing down a little bit not being, you know, still growing, but just not as red hot. Would that be another way of looking at it?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, right? So I'm not the economist, but when you think about it, the market likes free money more than it likes a really hot economy. Right. Inflation has been trending in the right direction, right? That's, I think, incontrovertible at this point. But the market really would like to see the Fed cut. Now, the thing that's interesting about that, interest rates where they are, call it 4-5% on the 10-year yield, like we've mentioned many times, that aren't particularly high from a historical perspective.
Right.
So the market really liked this 2% kind of money, or whatever you want to call it, which is essentially free money. So,
right,
you know, the market's going to give free money a bigger thumbs up than it's going to give a, you know, call it a hot economy.
And did the State of the Union move any needle at all up there?
We got virtually no questions on that at all, right? I mean, I think the most important thing from a U.S. government perspective to keep an eye on is the federal budget's supposed to drop, what, Monday or Tuesday this week. And the defense budget, you know, the national security spending and defense budget in there are, I think, what people are going to care about for sure.
Indeed, and we're going to have a commentary and a lot of analysis on that next week. Sash, take it away, and also follow up on Ron's question to you in the process of your answer, sir.
Yeah, I mean, look, I'll start. I think Ron's absolutely right. Markets like free money. Free money is just is terribly good for markets when you take that away, even bit by bit, and that's what quantitative tightening is. It forces investors to start looking at valuations in a much more rational way, because they've actually, you know, they've got to look at the returns that they're going to get on, or the hoped for returns they're going to get on equities, compared to the pretty locked in returns they're going to get on fixed income, and indeed on banks. You know, I mean, if banks will give you 5% for a 1-year loan now, that's a very high hurdle rate for some equities. And particularly if you think that that rate is going to persist for, you know, beyond the end of this calendar year, it makes, you know, it's making investors at the margin more valuation sensitive than they have been, frankly, any time in the last decade and a half. So yeah, it's a really interesting thing. I wouldn't say that it changed dramatically in Europe this week, but it's definitely an issue that we get more comments about, where, you know, clients are at least as interested in the valuation issues associated with any given stock as they are in the, you know, the fundamental issues associated with what does it make, who does it sell it to, what margins are they making, what's the free cash flow, everything else. They really want to boil down to check that the valuation justifies all of those other good or bad things. So, I mean, yeah, looking at the European markets this week, better week for civil than defense. But actually, there were some fairly big moves even between that. So, you know, Airbus up 3.6%. The paradox is that Airbus was up 3.6% and they produced a set of orders and deliveries numbers for February where they didn't have very many orders and they didn't have very many deliveries. But the market's looking through that. The market is saying they're winning. One, they, you know, Boeing is doing incrementally less well, albeit part of that is sort of regulatory and so forth, and therefore Airbus will do better in the future. That may well be simplistic. And, you know, the analysis we do, which tries to look at the sort of the rolling average over a 24-month basis of the number of A320neo family aircraft that Airbus is delivering, suggests there's no breakout there. You know, they're still producing about 48 aircraft a month. Well, that's a full quarter shy of where they should be, which is somewhere up in the 60s. And it's going to be really interesting to see when they finally break out of that, because if they don't, then numbers for this year, but even more numbers for next year, are way optimistic. That's a big challenge for them. But against that, in civil, one of the biggest suppliers to Airbus, the company called Melrose, but I think almost everybody would know it's a GKN Aerospace, they had results, didn't raise their guidance very much, and the shares were off 3.6%, right, having been off a pretty ugly 5-6% on the day. So here's a subcontractor. It's not quite the European version of Spirit, but it's a, you know, that's an easy analogy to make. Which is just, is not seeing the market grow as much as the OEM's production figures would suggest. And then the other interesting thing is, look at the aero engine companies. MTU which is clearly very closely tied to Pratt & Whitney, Raytheon Technologies. They had a great week, up 4.2%. Rolls-Royce is pretty good, up 3%. But Safran, which is the absolute, you know, the direct partner of GE, and you would have hoped or expected, would be dragged up in share price terms by the very strong performance of GE Aerospace this week. And Safran was up 1%. So what does that tell us? Market thinks it's in the price. They already knew that LEAP was going to do very well, and that, you know, was going to overtake CFM56 in terms of revenues this decade. And European investors just shrugged that off. So it's a funny old world. And then finally, Thales, which had a dreadful performance a couple of weeks ago, clawed all that back on a set of numbers that were fine, but probably not a lot better. But the market was very sensitive to their space business. And it's one of those funny things, you know, we're realizing, which we do every cycle, the space isn't actually as big as you think it is when you look at it financially. Right. Thales' space business has been a real cause for concern for some investors, but actually, yeah, it's doing poorly, but the rest of the business is doing well enough to compensate for that. So, you know, very, very mixed week. Overall, civil up 1.5-2%, defense pretty much flat.
And how did the State of the Union address go over? You know, our producer and editorial guru, Chris Cervello, noted to me, you know, as the speech was going on, that this speech domestically has little to do with words, right? It was all about optics. Does Biden look energetic? Does he look his age? Does he not look his age? Does he, you know, does Joe still have his mojo? Whereas internationally, it had everything to do with words and what the president was saying. Ultimately, how is it received from a, you know, in Europe?
I'm not sure that I actually share that. You know, that pair of visions of it. I think ultimately, because this year of all years, Europeans see the State of the Union as being about President Biden's re-election campaign, how it looked was at least as important to investors as how it sounded. For certainly in the aerospace and defense sector in Europe, a re-election of former President Trump would be a massive change to consensus and how everything happens. And so, you know, watching how President Biden performed effectively was very, very important. But, you know, net, there was remarkably little cut through in terms of share prices. I think we're going to have to wait a couple of weeks or so, see how the polls develop before investors start baking in expectations for, you know, for November. And even then, they're going to be very, very poorly based, those expectations. So there's a lot, you know, there's a lot of people politically in Europe who I think are biting their nails on this one. I'm afraid they're going to be bitten to the bone by the end of the year.
Richard, I want to go to you to start off the Boeing part of the conversation. On the one hand, some orders, American Airlines ordering jets. You know, one of the reasons they developed the MAX was that American gave them an ultimatum when they were buying the A321neo, and that's what led to the MAX program. At first, well, laughing it off until, you know, American was like, look, you know, Airbus is going to get all 600 of our orders unless you develop a new airplane. And so they went ahead and they developed a new airplane that is now getting them into a little bit of trouble. Talk to us a little bit about rate and the orders. And then I want to follow up with you and open the discussion up about, right, we now have a Justice Department federal investigation, it looks like, into what happened with the entire door plug matter. And unfortunately, United Airlines has had a little bit of a turn in the barrel, some of which with Boeing airplanes, is, you know, 777 wheel fell off, you know, and then a rudder control issue that apparently the Federal Aviation Administration has shown that, well, you know, the United pilots that had a stability problem where they couldn't use the rudder on landing, you know, was in a handful of planes that fell into that category as well. And then to add insult, I suppose, to injury, John Oliver, one of the nation's leading comics, thoughtful comics, took aim at Boeing at what was an absolute dismantlement, unfortunately, of the company, which nobody wants to be on the receiving end of that. Anyway, walk us through all of these sort of themes and what they tell us this week.
Yeah, you know, I guess the sort of macro, you know, the big picture is the world just can't quit Boeing, no matter how awful. You know, I mean, you've got this possible criminal investigation. You've got some truly cutting humor, a company that's done a great job laying itself open to that cutting humor. And yet, well, it's a duopoly with high barriers to entry. And you don't want to give a lot of pricing power to the other guy. And you don't want to be dependent upon Airbus's ability to ramp up production. So therefore, you still have to order Boeings. And that's what we saw with the American order. Although I would argue that maybe the sort of less obvious aspect of the American order was the large Embraer 175 order. You know, the regional part of the industry has been shockingly quiet. The only really quiet part of the entire aerospace industry, civil and military. So, you know, getting basically 3 years of production at recent rates, all of a sudden arriving on the 175 was definitely a plus, and pretty clear that maybe regionals are, you know, back. And there's really just one producer there, unless you count ATR turboprops that are completely absent from the North American market. But anyway, you know, you've just got this reluctance by anybody to completely depend upon Airbus. And so, you know, more Maxes are the only possible answer. It continues to be very hard to see how this ends. You know, you just have the situation getting a bit more absurd with politicians, regulators, and possibly now the Justice Department, and certainly the nation's comedian core. But yet, it's the only other game in town other than Airbus.
Well, it wasn't necessarily that it was comic, right? I mean, it was also the factual elements of it that played into it. Ron, let me bring you into this. You know, what's your, you know, sense about where the company is now? Right? I mean, unfortunately, it's going to get a lot worse before it gets better. But what is it that you're seeing in terms of, you know, the orders? And Sash, want to get your take on this in a moment as well. In terms of the orders, in terms of the broader narrative, right? Because every time there's an incident, doesn't matter what airline it's with, you know, there, a couple of weeks ago, I think we talked about it, was a United 757, and people were like, oh, you know, it's a Boeing. Okay, I mean, it's a Boeing that is 20 years old, you know, or the newest one is 20 years old, right? And if an incident in a wheel or something like that happens, it's more a maintenance issue necessarily than it is an original design issue. Anyway, take it away, Ron, in terms of sort of where we are in this week's news flow on it.
Yeah, I think, you know, we've had some incoming from investors that have been worried about, you know, why is all this stuff happening to Boeing airplanes? Well, like you said, some of it's just, you know, in the maintenance category. You know, I would argue probably most 757s you're flying on now are, call it 25 years old, plus or minus some. Some are pretty old, right? I've joked about this before, but if you walk into the laboratory of the airplane and it's got that blue spinny water, you know it's a really old airplane. They haven't done that long time. And that's a lot of 57s are like that. I mean, I just flew on one to Denver like that on United. And it's a fine airplane, but, you know, maintenance happens, and, you know, none of that stuff's catastrophic or anything. It is what it is. When you think about rudder pedals getting stuck, maybe that's more worrisome. In fact, if it's, you know, not just a one-off thing, but there's maybe a small cohort of airplanes that has that, you got to wonder why, what's going on there. Now, Boeing more broadly, what's, you know, kind of fascinating about it, and I think you kind of described it well, your marketing campaign can't be, we're just the only thing you can get, right? Like, we're the only other game in town, and that's why you're going to buy our airplane. You know, that's not going to be a winning strategy over kind of the medium term. You know, when you talk to investors, it's a concern. It's interesting how the stock has traded, right? Because given the news flow and everything that has happened, you might expect the shares actually to be lower than they are. But it's this tension between, okay, you have this company that has these issues across, you know, many things, right, including defense, but being offset by a super robust civil cycle recovery. I mean, it's not a normal civil cycle, right?
Right.
It's a civil cycle out of a pandemic low, which is, you know, in the jet age, I think even in the flying age, unprecedented. So, you know, you've got this, you know, really, really strong cycle offset by the things that are impacting the company. It's that tension that I think is driving where the shares are. I think if you were to speak to many investors, they might have their toe in the water on it, but given the nature of the headlines and what's going on, it's hard for an investor to hedge against that. So, you know, many investors try to, you know, quote unquote, kind of hedge their risk, and they can take a view on a cycle. They can take a view on an economic number, but they can't take a view on something going wrong on an airplane. So it's that's where they are. And my sense is if you can get this A, news cycle behind us, and B, some of the true fundamentals that are driving it behind us, you know, the shares would probably do better. But until that happens, I think, you know, it's stuck in a range, right? And that's just the sad reality. And I think the American order is pretty fascinating, right? Because you get the split between, you know, Boeing and Airbus. And like Richard mentioned, that was a gigantic order for Embraer. And, you know, my sense there, it's not just that they're the only regional game in town, but maybe American sending a signal. Yeah, we want these guys to be healthy, and we want them around, because having a potential optional third OEM might not be a bad idea.
Right. Although you're saying that you don't want an ad campaign to be predicated on we're the only other game in town, unfortunately, for a very long period of time, especially from some heritage McDonald executives, the answer was, where else are they going to go? So there has been a little bit of that in the newer Boeing culture that was sort of like, yeah, they'll still buy it from us, unfortunately, right? Which also could be coloring the company's decision to not develop another airplane. They're going to buy one from us anyway, if it, as long as it's not, you know, unsafe, or is going to end up costing airlines money. And as Richard has said, right, I mean, the economics of the 737 are, you know, not that bad, ultimately, even in comparison to what Airbus is building. Sash, your take on this before we go briefly to business jets, right? I mean, that did come up a little bit in the wake of the president's comments in the State of the Union. Anyway, let's get your take on the Boeing matter.
Yeah, I mean, you know, as far as what the market share for new orders is panning out to be and is at the moment, I mean, I suspect Boeing will do okay in terms of orders, you know, this year, next year, and so forth, because Airbus is sold out. You know, Airbus is taking orders in through 2030 now. I'm sure that Airbus will try to ramp production, but at the moment, it just isn't working, and I suspect they won't be able to manage a production ramp above 75 until 2028 or thereabouts. So Airbus is going to out-deliver Boeing at least 60-40 and possibly even 2-1, which is a horrible position to be in economically. But actually, I suspect the orders will be a little bit better than that for Boeing, because they have potentially got capacity 2-4 years out, whereas Airbus potentially has none at all over that period. Airlines, yeah, I'm sure they want to keep a second player very much in the game, and I'm sure that they want to make sure that they can get some sort of near-term slots. Here's the worry, though. Ron's absolutely right. You know, we are in the most astonishing recovery from the pandemic, because everything fell so fast in 2020, and the recovery and the pace of the ramp for everybody is pretty giddy making stuff. But I do think we've got to remember that this is a cyclical industry. Cycles do happen. They typically are broadly the same time frame as economic cycles. And sometime towards the end of this decade, this cycle will come to an end in some way, shape, or form. The cycle we had in the 20-teens was incredibly unusual. It was effectively a double cycle, because Chinese economic growth dragged up the rest of Southeast Asia and meant that even when the West, the developed economies, should have been turning down, and in previous cycles that would have brought the whole industry down, the Chinese and Southeast Asian airlines overall kept the cycle going. Well, that's not going to happen this time, because that growth has occurred. You know, China is actually reverting much more towards a 5%, 4-5% norm than the 8% plus that it was in the 20-teens. So we are going to get a cycle. Seems to me there's not a lot of point in taking orders for 2030. I mean, I'm not saying that they're not going to do it, but right, you know, orders for 2030, you should put at a big discount in your model compared to orders for 2027, say, because the likelihood is that a recession will have come along in the meantime, because that's what they always do, with the one exception we just had. And that one exception does not is not precedent. It's just an exception.
Richard, want to come back to you on that, whether or not you've got any closing thoughts, and then introduce us briefly. I want to talk about private jets. We have to talk about Palantir, and there are a lot of defense stuff that I want to mention. And I know, Sash, you want to get to business jets, so you might be next up on the queue to take a bite of this. But the president, during the State of the Union, did say that he would be cracking down on corporate jet loopholes. That drew protests from the National Business Aviation Association, as well as airlines across or Alliance for Aviation across America, excuse me, not Airlines for America, saying that, business aviation is critical to the country. I don't think the president was saying get rid of business aviation, but he's talking about loopholes there. Anyway, to finish up, any thoughts you have on Boeing, and then take us into, whatever impact this is going to have on business aviation.
Yeah, a couple thoughts. One is, yes, this is a cyclical industry per se, but we haven't started the cycle to any meaningful degree. That's the funny thing. You look at previous cycles, we're not only far below in terms of where we should be in terms of growth rates relative to the starting year, but this is also the only so-called recovery cycle where the first year after hitting bottom was actually pretty much exactly the same or even slightly lower because of the 787 grounding or production shut. So in other words, we might have an elongated production cycle on the basis of these rather horrible production snafus. That's, I guess, good for a longer cycle, even though it won't be the kind of, what Sash said, we're not going to see that double impact of China and other factors, especially that divergence between capital and fuel. But, I think from a public standpoint, the frustrating aspect of it is I think everyone wants to send two messages simultaneously. One is that, we need Boeing to succeed because we can't just have one company with monopoly pricing. But on the other hand, we need to send a signal to Boeing management that this is seriously not acceptable. So I think Boeing management so far has only heard the first message. So that's got to be deeply frustrating for everybody involved, and not good for Boeing in the long run either, as Ron said. Now, in terms of business aircraft, we've heard this sort of thing before, whether it's activist investors or whether it's governments or people concerned about the carbon footprint, none of this is showing up in the numbers, right? I mean, the most you can say is that, occasionally people do flee into Part 91K and 135 fractional or charter rather than flight department, actual ownership. But in terms of actual demand, it's pretty strong right now. So in other words, I expect we'll see much ado about nothing despite all the optics and talk.
Ron, just your quick sense, given that you watch obviously Gulfstream very closely, and then Sash, I know you got a point that you want to make about Dassault. Go ahead, Ron.
Yeah, I agree with Richard. I mean, I think probably the peak of the anti-business jet rhetoric was during the financial crisis. That probably did weigh on the industry for a while, but the reality is, it's a very important industry to the United States and the U.S., North America writ large, throw Canada in, is the largest market for corporate aviation. So, it's a market that's important for our economy. It's also the largest market. And given the headwinds of airline travel and what happened during the pandemic, and the pool of users for private aviation is larger today than it was before the pandemic. It's obviously not as big as it was during the pandemic. And then two, the supply chain constraints we've talked about ad nauseum for Boeing and Airbus, and even some of the large defense contractors, on many levels, it's been even worse for the business jet manufacturers because they're just smaller volumes and smaller companies. And, they tend to get the real kind of, whip effect of all this. So they haven't been even close to overproducing where demand is. So I'm expecting a business jet cycle to be very extended, given the supply chain hurdles and constraints that industry has dealt with. And like Richard said, you're not you're not seeing it in numbers, you're not seeing it in demand. And, you know, it's kind of, if you want to look at folks flying around in business aviation, it can be a really hot point for populist politics. But in the end, at least at this point, it doesn't seem like it's going to make much of a difference.
Sash, you want to take what, you know, weigh in on this and also bridge us to Dassault?
Yeah, I mean, actually, they're one and the same. I mean, these are some comments that came out from Dassault's results meetings and calls this week. And then the results themselves were, you know, nothing terribly newsworthy coming out of them. You know, it's going to take a year or so for Rafale production to build up. But I thought what they said about business jets was very, very interesting indeed. Now, clearly, you've got to read this through at least two prisms. One is, Dassault is a European-based business jet manufacturer rather than a US-based business jet manufacturer. It just has a different hinterland, even though it clearly is very, very successful in the US as well. And the other, I think, is that because historically Dassault has been less exposed to the very large, very long-range biz jets, the large Gulfstreams, the Global Expresses, you know, Dassault has tended to be half a notch below them. They are clearly feeling that has been a, or is becoming a real disadvantage for them, and they can't wait to get the Falcon 10X, which is very big indeed, out. Here's the problem, it's going to take them a year longer than they thought. So Falcon 10X won't be delivered until probably 27-28. And that's a disadvantage for them. But what I thought was particularly interesting was that Eric Trappier spent a lot of time in his press conference talking about problems of effectively the ESG movement, but more specifically the European Union. The European Union is not, by most people's definition, a terribly populist organization. There are clearly populists in there, but it tends to be very, very consensual in what it does. But the European Union is heavily pushing sustainability. And there is a particular directive, and it works by directives, called the Corporate Sustainability Reporting Directive, CSRD, which requires corporates to report, you know, what they do that's destroying the planet compared to what they do that's making everybody, you know, happier and weller. And Dassault is actually taking the European Commission to court because the CSRD wording appears to show or appears to penalise bizjet companies more than it does airliner companies. There's only one in Europe, and that's Airbus. And it appears to penalise companies that produce aircraft that emit CO2 more than it does to penalise airlines that actually fly the things, or indeed operators that fly the things. But net, they're feeling really attacked by the European Union. They're feeling that the whole sustainability movement is actually acting against them at the moment, and that is putting customers off. Now, this may be a purely a European point of view, in which case Gulfstream and Bombardier will to an extent shrug it off. But sometimes the European Union is quite early to adopt issues like this. And I think it's something we really should watch, because Dassault were clearly concerned that this is squeezing their business in a way that they hadn't expected. It was a real change from a year ago. And ultimately, the EU does try to be supranational. Doesn't always succeed, but it does try to be. And this is the sort of thing that could make it very difficult for people flying biz jets into Europe, as well as inside Europe.
Ron, you want to weigh in from kind of just briefly from a Wall Street standpoint on that, more broadly on sustainability, either you or Ron? You or Richard, excuse me.
Yeah, I mean, when you think about sustainability and aviation, I mean, we could talk about this for hours, and the slice of the carbon pie that business aviation actually creates, it's eatsy-meensy. Now, on a per-user basis, so if you're flying around and you're whatever, and it's your jet, there's two or three of you on it, the amount of carbon you're emitting per person is, if you want to, you know, do it on a share basis, is, you know, you're hitting way above your weight, right? Your share is way higher than it would be if you're sharing that carbon with folks on a, say, a 737 or an A320. But if business aviation altogether went away tomorrow, like say they just shut the whole thing down, it wouldn't make a dent in the carbon issue. And the other things, and I'm comfortable saying this, that the environmental sustainability aviation community has to get their head around is SAF is great, but it's going to take a humongous investment to get it in place. We're not going to be flying around in anything that's the size of what we think of as a jet transport today that's being powered by hydrogen or batteries in any decade soon. So, you know, I know Richard's talked about this before, that, you know, we're going to have at least one more generation of, you know, the turbofans that we know and love. And they're just going to have to get their head around it. It's just the way it is. So anyway, yeah.
Sash, you've got your hand up.
Yeah, I just want to pick up on that point that Ron made about SAF, because I think that's absolutely fascinating. And I detected on Dassault's two calls a real concern that legislators, in the case of Dassault, this means the European Union, are falling out of love with SAF. And I think Dassault is concerned that SAF may not be the way even to achieve the greenwashing that some of their customers need, let alone real gains. And I think that if SAF doesn't work, that actually makes Airbus's life a ton more difficult and Boeing's life a ton more difficult, and the engine companies. Yes, they may well get another generation of engines out of it, but it's going to be a very, very short generation in our view, you know, under a decade. I think this is the, you know, but SAF was seen as being the holy grail by a lot of airlines. That argument is just weakening, feels like to me, by the week at the moment.
We're going to go into a lightning round in a moment, but a quick word from our sponsors. The Defense and Aerospace Report and its family of publications is brought to you by Bell, HII, General Atomics Aeronautical Systems, GE Aerospace, Leonardo DRS, and American Rheinmetall. Richard, do you want to weigh in briefly on this before we really have to hit a lightning round of a lot of defense stuff that we've got to talk about before we wrap the program up? Go ahead.
Sure. I mean, look, this is a political question too. And, you know, let's face facts. Dassault is an exporter, a significant exporter with a great deal of soft power. And not only that, but the people behind them come from a politically conservative, indeed right-wing part of France, and that part is likely to be the ascendance. So the idea of their export business being clamped down upon anytime soon by a right-wing or center-right government is very unlikely, in my view. I don't think...
Interesting indeed. Really quickly, Sash, what's the new Rafale rate? Because I know that there are some people in our audience who have been tracking this as we've covered their extraordinary wins, but also the challenges of actually increasing production, because they have a way of doing things, and their way of doing things might not be with the degree of alacrity that people would want. Then again, there's also a very, very long waiting list for Falcons, right? Anyway, give us a sense on rate and what it all means.
Wow, it's a whole another 1 hour program.
You've got about a minute and a half to do with it.
So first of all, Falcon is hampered by, this is again exactly what Ron said, very, very small subcontractors who generally put the B team onto it because the A team are working for Airbus. And the supply chain is really hurting Falcon at the moment. Interestingly, particularly in France, but I think that's because Falcon has tended to focus on French subcontractors for, you know, reasons of sort of subcontractor intimacy, but they tend to be a lot smaller. So they've got problems there. Rafale is fascinating. Rafale production is building up, but is not going to rise much this year. You know, a few aircraft only. Rises quite a lot more in 25, a lot more 26, 27, 28. You know, the headline is Dassault no longer talks about 3 aircraft per month as being a ceiling. We've talked about this a lot. You know, 3 aircraft a month was what Dassault has historically said. They would find it hard to get through, but they're clearly now looking at producing more than that. And they need to. They've got this massive order from the United Arab Emirates, 80-odd aircraft. They've got an order from India for Rafales for the Navy. They've got an order for 42 aircraft for France and another 42 from Indonesia. So they've got to raise rates. I reckon they're going to be at closer to 4 than 3 towards the end of the decade. And then, this is probably the important thing, they can probably sustain around three a month well into the 2030s. And that's what they need to do to bridge to SCAF as and when that happens. And they seem to be in a very, very strong position in that regard. But anyway, you know, they're breaking this three per month ceiling that has been a cause of huge frustration to customers as well as to investors.
Richard, anything you want to briefly say about Rafale?
Yeah, you know, just the dynamics of the Saudi market here, because at one point they were looking likely to go with Rafales because they wanted balance between the U.S. and Europe, and because Eurofighter Tranche 2 wouldn't be available for European or for German human rights concerns. Amazing how that's all been taken care of in the past couple of weeks. It's pretty clear that, as SAF says, the Rafale folks can deliver them a jet sometime in the 2030s, which is probably unappealing, given that they want to retire their Tornadoes a lot before then. And meanwhile, the Germans seem to have come around. So it looks like it'll be Eurofighter Tranche 2 rather than Rafales. And I'm sure, you know, that in an ideal world, the Dassault folks would have ramped up to rate 4 or rate 5 or whatever it took to satisfy all this amazing demand.
Ron, can I go over to you? A huge win for Palantir on the Titan contract, wasn't it? I mean, Raytheon is a company that's normally in the lead when it comes to systems like that. What's the importance of this win that transcends what would appear to be kind of a small vehicle, right? Small battlefield vehicle, even if it's packed to the gills with some of the most advanced technology the Army has in some respects.
Yeah, this is the first case where Palantir is the lead prime on hardware. So it's that's the big deal, right? So it's you know, the first win like that, particularly of this new generation of defense companies. And the size of the contract itself isn't, you know, particularly huge. It's a couple hundred million bucks a year over a period of years, but it's the point that in the, you know, the software data company is now come, in this case at least, a hardware prime. And I can't imagine that that didn't go unnoticed, not just in, you know, RTX's strategy, but other companies, defense primes who are looking at, you know, this new generation of contractors, Palantir, Shield AI, Anduril, there's a whole list of them, and what impact they could potentially really have. Because it's probably pretty easy, I would imagine, sitting around in a strategy meeting at one of the old guard saying, yeah, these new kids don't know what's going to happen. But you know, maybe this is an indicator that they're really starting to shake things up.
It is going to be very interesting to watch. And we had Brandon Tseng from Shield AI on the program last week, if people want to check out that discussion, right? I mean, one of the triumvirate of new companies that people are talking about sort of breaking into the business. Sash, let me go to you on a quick war thing. And Richard, you're going to answer about some of the challenges that United recently has had. Sash, just quickly on the war, right? Tensions are simmering between Germany and France, obviously over the Taurus decision and some of the comments Olaf Scholz has made. And then we had the leak of the recording that the Russians intercepted. A German general officer joined his compatriots in a discussion on transferring Taurus to Ukraine, disclosing some of those capabilities. He was on an unsecure line, again, having joined from the Singapore air show. It was recorded and then released. And, you know, the general officers had a little bit of bafflement about why their boss is not authorizing the Taurus and what the workarounds would be on how targeting and what have you could be done. And Russia appears to be so empowered that it's willing to try to take out Volodymyr Zelensky, even if he is with the Greek prime minister, which happened when the two leaders were in Odessa and a Russian ballistic missile landed 300 feet from them and they didn't have a chance to even get in a bunker. The Russians claimed they weren't targeting the two, that it was they were targeting a warehouse, but I'm not sure why you would believe anything that would come out of Moscow. But anyway, what do you make of both of these incidents and what they tell us at this point, given that really it's all about aid and the Ukrainians are not getting as much aid as they need, ultimately, including from Germany, who has, you know, pledged aid and help and is not really giving it, and it's annoying the living daylights out of the Elysee.
Yeah, well, listen, I'll start. It's not often that I feel slightly sorry for Chancellor Scholz, and I'm sure it won't happen again. But if I had to deal with general officers who are so moronic that they discuss highly classified information on WebEx and then don't think they're going to be intercepted by hostile actors, I mean, you know, that is beyond unprofessional. And I'm astonished that those individuals were not summarily dismissed, because it is, you know, it's all very well to say, oh, well, you know, this was a there are people saying this was an accident. It was just, you know, there was no way it should have been intercepted, but it was just a fluke. That's utter bull. You do not use unsecure means to discuss highly secure issues. And it's worse because actually what they were talking about was what their allies are doing in Ukraine. If all they were doing was talking about whether Germany was going to export Taurus or not, fine, you know, right. I mean, mess around with your own country's interests if that's what you really have to do when you're wearing a uniform. But once they start talking about the UK and France, they are really, really dropping us in it as well. So thanks a bundle, Luftwaffe. That was great. I mean, this highlights the fact that Germany is finding it very, very hard to lead in terms of adding extra capabilities for Ukraine. They always say, well, we're not doing it because we don't want to escalate. Well, it seems to me that it's a very odd way to fight a proxy war, where you always let the other guy escalate, but you don't do it yourself, or you don't let your ally do it themselves. If we are always fighting on the basis that we will only respond, we won't initiate new capabilities, the Ukrainians are going to lose. And that is something that is causing other European allies an increasing amount of concern. Taurus is a cruise missile. It's pretty similar, frankly, to Storm Shadow or Scalp, French equivalent. There are people who tell you it's got better range, better warhead, or this and that. But they are very, very analogous. They are brilliant at dealing with hard targets. It's exactly what you need. And you need it by the dozen to utterly destroy the Kerch Bridge. But if Germany won't export it, then the Ukrainians are fighting with, you know, at least one hand behind their back and probably a foot as well. And that's really difficult. So net, aid to Ukraine is not happening as quickly as it should. That is made worse by the fact that the US, for reasons of its own, has stopped delivering aid because you've run out of authorized money. And although there is starting to be work to build up a Ukrainian defense industry, this is going to take multiple years, probably 2, 3, maybe even 4 years. The war could functionally be over by then, or at least it could have reached a stage where Ukraine is at an incredible disadvantage. And if that happens, then the rest of us in Europe have got massive problems. It's just the relationship between Scholz and Macron, President Macron of France, is just made worse, I think, by the fact that President Macron doesn't have another election to fight. So he can actually start saying what he wants rather than what he right. thinks he can get away with politically. Scholz doesn't have that luxury. But you could argue this is still opening out the sores between the two countries, which do have different world views and very, very different views on defence. I thought what was fascinating is that the head of the German opposition, Mr. Merz, did a speech this week that was way more hawkish on aid to Ukraine. He's really starting now to differentiate between himself and Scholz. And given that Scholz's polling is really low, that starts to make how Germany behaves on a 12-18 month view really worth watching. But the Ukrainians would rather, for very good reasons, that it happened rather quicker than that.
And it is amazing that even within the German Traffic Light Coalition, there are others who are much, much tougher when it comes to aid on Ukraine, including Annalena Baerbock, his foreign minister, and indeed Boris Pistorius, his defense secretary, yes. is pretty tough and forward leaning, and appears to have been 100% behind the Taurus export. Very briefly, what does Russia targeting a foreign leader mean? Do you think, right? I mean, they have always done strikes when foreign leaders are visiting, but they've always tried to keep the strikes away from them, not 300 feet from both of them.
I'm actually inclined to believe this was cock up rather than anything else. And here's why. Because of the, you know, of the medium-sized NATO stroke EU countries, Greece has historically been much more pro-Russian than many others in sort of Central Europe, partly because of shared Christian orthodoxy. And so to go around, I mean, you know, targeting Zelensky is regrettably fair game for the Russians.
Right.
I think the Russians would be incredibly unwise to target the Greek prime minister, because he's probably, from their point of view, one of their few, you know, crypto allies within the EU. So I don't suspect he was targeted deliberately. I think it was in that respect, it was very, you know, almost any other European prime minister would have done from the point of view of Russia.
Correct. But Mitsotakis has also been unremittingly supportive of Ukraine as well, and a very prominent voice on that, obviously. I mean, he wouldn't have been in Odessa. He wouldn't have been in Odessa, of all places, professing his support. OK, we're almost we are heavy on this show, as we would say in the audio business. I am a lifetime United traveler. And the airline has very, I know I'm going to live to regret this, but rarely let me down. And I've never been in a situation where I've had to divert. And unfortunately, there've been four in the past month emergency landings. A wheel came off of a 777 and a couple of other incidents. Ron, you're a technical advisor to the company, but the question's not directed at you. Richard, you know, you track and you follow this stuff. Is this anything more broadly endemic, do you think? Is it a turn in the barrel? And at what point does it become an issue, right? I mean, I can't imagine Scott Kirby and the management team aren't really looking at this and going like, okay, this is not looking bad for a company that prides itself on having a very good safety record.
I mean, I think it's something they have to watch very closely and make sure all processes and practices are being followed. But the most likely explanation is that capacity is tight and a lot of older equipment is staying around longer than expected. That is almost certainly it. But yes, it's something they need to watch very closely. And part of it also, of course, is that they're very big. So, you know, just when you have that, you know, you're kind of more likely to be hit by random glitches and whatever and have it show up on an anecdotal level just because there's so many jets. But to me, it's really just a capacity. As Ron said before, 757s, they're a quarter of a century old. They're being kept around like a lot of other jets longer than expected, and they're maybe a little more likely to have glitches. But yeah, they got to get in front of this.
Guys, thanks so very much for joining us. We really appreciate it. Wouldn't be a Sunday unless you guys were joining us. Thanks so very much. A reminder to our audience to check out our award-winning weekly podcasts, Cavus Ships, co-hosted by Chris Cavus and Chris Cervello, and sponsored by HII and GE Aerospace, who clear the fog on naval and maritime matters. The Downlink with Laura Winter, who takes a thoughtful look at all things space, and the Air Power podcast, sponsored by GE Aerospace, that I co-host with our own JJ Gertler. Tune in again tomorrow for our Look Ahead podcast, where Byron Callen of Capital Alpha Partners joins us, as well as Joy Schaffler of Distinctive Edge Partners, to give us an update on her big technology competition down at South by Southwest that we are covering remotely. Until then, hope everybody has a great day, and we'll see you again soon. Thanks very much.